So, good evening and welcome to our grand finale of Advice for Life. Tonight's topic, lesson number 6, Spiritual Heights. As they say, JLI also saves the best for last. So, you can look forward to an exciting ride tonight. I am super excited about it myself. And I'm as sad as it is to conclude, but it's going to be an excellent conclusion. But first, there were two friends which met each other after a long time of not seeing each other. And one says to the other, "How are you doing?" And he answers his friend and he says, "I was recently at my doctor and he said, I have to quit smoking." And he says, "Really?" He says, "Yes." He says, "I don't know what to do because this is going to be a big change. I've been with this doctor for 30 years, and it's time for a new doctor now." So, tonight's topic, after the last 5 weeks of talking about and digging in to the Rebbe's advice on topics of work, of family, of health in general, physical health, mental health, as well as how to deal with challenges and adversity that we discussed last week. We're going to conclude this week talking about personal growth from the Rebbe's perspective and advice that he gave on everything related to personal growth. We're going to learn about that. We're also going to learn about how you can become an influencer, not on Instagram, the other kind. And we're also going to learn what is Chabad's greatest secret to its success. Everyone talks about Chabad's growth and Chabad's success, and everyone thinks they know the secret. Today, we're really going to find out. Certainly one of the top 3 secrets. Maybe even number 1. Who knows? So, we have an exciting discussion tonight, and we're going to jump right in, talking about personal growth and as we basically have ingrained, instilled in our very DNA as human beings, the need to grow and to improve. Everyone is trying to become a better version of themselves. We're trying to be a better spouse, a better father, a better son or daughter. We're trying to gain knowledge. We're always trying to learn more. Look, we're all gathered here together right now. We're always trying to improve. And we never just settle for what is. And this is true in every area, in the sciences and in our personal level of knowledge, across the board, in everything. Whatever we have, but we're always probing and searching to discover more, to uncover something new, and to not just take things the way they are and settle with the status quo. There are thousands of self-help books on the shelves at your local bookstores, at your Barnes & Noble, if they still have them. Do they? Yeah, there are some still here and there. So somebody once came in and approached the counter and he asked, "Where's the self-help section?" And he said, "If I tell you, I'll be defeating the purpose." So the self-help industry in the United States is over $13 billion. This is true of books, it's true of seminars, it's true of retreats, it's true of YouTube stuff, and it's just unending. So you would think that everything on the topic of self-help has already been said. What exactly will the Rebbe be adding to the mix? But as we will learn tonight, the Rebbe had a very different counterintuitive approach. The way he approached things himself and the way he guided people who turned to him. And remember, people turned to him by the thousands and the tens of thousands for questions, for guidance, for advice, for blessing. And thank God we are blessed to have, hello, Alina. Good evening. And we're blessed to have access to this wealth of information, of responses, of guidance, of advice that he gave. And tonight we're going to dig into that advice on this topic. So the Rebbe's advice on this topic is revolutionary, as I said. And we actually have a little quote here on text number one. Please join me on page 145 in your books. It's a short one, but it makes this point very succinctly from Ecclesiastes. Jake, you want to open?
Sure.
Text number one, please.
How many understand that the spirit of the human ascends on high, while the spirit of the beast descends to the earth?
Thank you. This is how King Solomon put it, that the spirit of the human ascends on high. What that means is that a human being is always trying to strive and aspire for higher. Whatever we have, whatever we achieved already, we want more, we want to learn more, we want to grow, and we want to not just be what we were yesterday. Today is a new day, new opportunities. We want to continue and constantly grow. So that we have from Ecclesiastes. I'm going to ask you to turn back a page, actually. We're going to go to page 144 for this exercise. If you don't mind taking a look at this. Exercise 6.1. Imagine that you resolve to grow in your spiritual and Jewish life. By the way, this is just one area of growth. We want to grow in every area. One of those areas is growing as a Jew. We all want to be that better Jew, better today than yesterday in that small way. So imagine that you resolve to grow in your spiritual and Jewish life. Here are six activities that will carry you in that direction. Number them in the order you believe you should follow. So just put a number, the six possibilities here. Make a suggestion of what should go first and what should go 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 as far as priorities when wanting to become a better Jew. I'll give you a few seconds. So let's just do this. What do you think would be number one? You can call out your answers too. Which one?
The third one.
The third one. Meditate on God. Okay, we're going to jump to six. Which one do you think is, of course, they're all important, but which one would be number six?
Two.
Three. You say number two.
Five.
You say number five, another mitzvah. Okay. Work at inspiring your fellow. You're saying that one should be number six?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Anyone else? One last answer?
For me, attend Shabbat service.
That would be number one?
No, number six.
Number six. Okay. 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 Good. Good insight. Good insight. So I think everyone agrees that regardless of how you arrange the first five, it sounds like, and I did hear it, that working at inspiring your fellow Jew should be, as far as this list is concerned, should be towards the end. Meaning first you grow and you work on self-mastery and grow as a Jew yourself, and then you turn your attention to other people. So far we established that we don't just settle and we want to grow in all areas of life, including spiritually, including to become a better person and a better Jew. So it's going to be exciting tonight. Everyone with me? So we're going to talk first. In order to appreciate what the Rebbe's approach really is, we have to first talk about what the classic approach is. And then we'll be able to compare and contrast and appreciate it all the more. So let's talk about the classical approach to self-improvement. And there are many, many ways, as we said, in the many, many different platforms that deal with self-help. However, if we can try to kind of package them together, the great majority of them fall under two general approaches. What we're going to call today, bottom up, okay? That's number one. Largely, the classic approach is bottom up. You start from the bottom, you work your way up. Number two, we're going to call it inside out. And we'll discuss both of these, both the bottom up and the inside out. You start from the inside and work your way out. So, if I ask you, anyone here ever climb a mountain? Which ones?
Rainier.
Where is that? Excuse my... Washington State. How about you?
No names.
All over the place. Okay, so if somebody is not really an avid mountain climber like me, and I would want to climb one, what should I do? From having the dream until doing it.
Buy sneakers.
Exercise. Train.
Have a guide.
Have a guide or God?
Guide.
Guide. Have a guide. Important. What else?
Start small.
Have a map.
Start small. Have a map. Okay. All.
Carry a phone.
All great things. All very correct. Somebody said diet, right? You have to get in shape first and you have to train and then get the right skills and get the equipment and the right tools and then you can consider launching. So that's true when you climb a mountain. That's also true when you want to climb higher and you want to achieve more in other areas. And we actually have a verse from Psalm 24, which we say it formally in our prayers, but we say it every Sunday. It's the song of the day for Sunday in our prayers. But we say it more publicly, if you will, on the evening of Rosh Hashanah. It's a regular evening service, but you add just Psalm 24 before Aleinu. So that's where it kind of gets more attention. We have two verses from this psalm. Jane, would you like to read them in English, please?
Sure. Who shall ascend the mountain of God? And who shall stand in his holy place? One who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not borne my soul into vanity, and has not sworn deceitfully.
Thank you. So it opens with saying, who can ascend the mountain of God, and who can stand in God's holy place? And then it tells you what it takes to climb this mountain. Because yes, God is everywhere. Yes, we all have an innate default connection with God, because we all possess a soul, a divine spark. However, God is infinite. So the journey toward God is also infinite. However close I got yesterday or today, tomorrow, there's infinite more to achieve. So King David in Psalms compares it to climbing a mountain, climbing the mountain of God, trying to ascend higher and to become all the more, let's say, spiritually sensitive and sensitized to God. How do we do that? By having a pure heart and clean hands, which could mean anything like we need to cleanse ourselves. We shouldn't from any immoral acts. We have to cleanse ourselves. Or if our mouth was used to say things we shouldn't, that should be cleansed. Our heart, etc. This is what basically the gist of what he's saying. One who has clean hands and a pure heart, that's someone who can climb the mountain of God. And these things are not easy. Like climbing an actual mountain, all these things take a lot of internal work. So if we want to get close to God, we have to do internal work. And that's real work. Anyone that engaged in any of it, even in the smallest way, any self-improvement takes work. It takes a lot of work. That's called getting in shape spiritually and to make sure we're honest and to make sure we're not sullied by anything questionable or even worse. So this approach is also indicated in another verse in Psalms. This is another short one. Linda, Psalm 34, please. Text 3.
Turn away from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it.
Thank you. So the classic approach when it comes to self-improvement, improvement follows a bottom-up progression. First to rectify negative tendencies, then advance spiritually. And that's what this verse is also telling us. Turn away from evil and then comes do good. In other words, if I'm going to start doing good things, but I'm still steeped in evil, then it's like the wrong approach. First, you got to clean things up. You got to clean up the inside. And then you could start doing good and adding positive energy and positive deeds to myself. And then they'll have value. They'll endure. But if I'm bringing these good deeds onto a unclean vessel, let's just say, then it's like counterintuitive. I believe I shared once on Shabbat about this guy that came from the shtetl. He came to see his friend in the big city, and it was Shabbos, and all the wonderful dishes, Shabbat dishes, were served. Anyone know what kishke is?
Yeah.
What's kishka? Okay. Yeah, but what do you call it as a dish?
Kishka.
That's the Yiddish. Any other term?
Dump-derma.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So anyway, this guy, this guest, has a taste of the kishka, and he's just blown away, out of this world. He says, I have to take the recipe back home. And they give him the recipe, he brings it home, and he asks his wife, this dish was like out of this world, if you can just copy this recipe. Of course, she does exactly as he asked, and he takes the first bite once it's ready, and chaloshes, he spit it out. He couldn't even though he asked, did you follow the ingredients, the rest, the instructions? She said, I did. Precisely, I don't know what happened. He goes back to his friend in the big city. Back to his friend and says, we followed the instructions. I don't know what. I couldn't even take a bite. He says, listen, I didn't tell you the obvious, but did you clean out the intestines first? So before we start doing good, we first have to clean out the intestines. That's what this verse of Psalm is telling us. Sur Meira means that we have to first turn away from evil, and then we can do good. And then that's pleasant. That's tasteful. That's kind of the protocol. That's the bottom up approach that we're talking about here. The bottom up approach is we said that you first have to clean out the inside, and then you advance. You start from the bottom, and then you advance forward, both from this verse and the previous one of climbing the mountain of God. You first have to purify yourself, and then there's somebody home, then you can actually appreciate and be sensitized to something good and something spiritual. So that's as far as the bottom-up approach is concerned. What about the inside-out approach? And remember, both of these are still the classical approach to self-improvement. What does inside-out mean? Inside-out, let's just read a short text, and these are very well-known. They're very short, all these, but they're very well-known in Jewish literature. Colin, text number 4, please. This is from the Talmud.
Beautify yourself, then beautify others.
Thank you. So now we're talking about, before we were talking about self-improvement. First, you have to start from the bottom and then advance upward. What about if I want to have a positive impact on other people? So here we say you need the inside-out approach. What does that mean? It means that first you have to beautify yourself and then beautify others. Similar to what we said before, but that's within oneself. You first have to clean out the negative before you bring on the positive. When it comes to working with others, as they say in Yiddish, "Vasfara panim betashabin." What does it look like if I'm going to go try to influence someone else positively, and I haven't begun to work on myself in that area? So you have to beautify yourself, and then you can beautify others. That's the inside out. Again, bottom up, and inside out is both of these are the classical approach. So, just like they say about the oxygen masks, right? They have to put on your own mask, and then you can put on someone else's, as they always remind us on the airplanes. There's a well-known Hasidic master. He was called the Kutsk, Rebbe of Kutsk, very known for his sharp wit. I believe my ancestry is kind of linked with that Hasidic stripe. Nothing to do with the sharp wit. I'm just saying, by the way. I believe my father's grandfather was an aide to the Sokolov Rebbe in Poland. And he was like an offshoot of Kutsk. Because Kutsk didn't really... There is no Kutsk dynasty today. And there's probably descendants, but there isn't a group with that name. So anyway, it kind of branched off. Bottom line is, he once said that when I was younger, I thought I was going to change the world. Then I grew a little older, and I realized that I'll change my city. I grew a little older, I realized I'll work on my neighborhood. When I got even older, I realized I'm going to work on my family. And when I got even older, I realized that the only one I could change is myself. Now, there's two ways to look at this statement. You can look at it cynically, and say that he thought he had these big grand plans and he thought the world is changeable and then got older and realized that it isn't and I could just change myself. But that's not really what he meant. He meant something else. He meant to say that the way to change the world, if I want to change the world, it's not by changing the world. It's by changing myself. Not that he gave up on changing the world. He just realized that the way to change the world is by changing oneself. As they say, be the change that you want to see. The only one I could change, and then when I change myself, then I'll be able to influence whatever I want my influence to be. But it's only through changing oneself. This is the gist of the inside-out approach. You have to start from the inside, you have to fix yourself, and then you can proceed to the outside and try to be a force for good to those around you. So, that's basically sums up the classic approach. Before, we talked about the bottom-up as far as cleansing yourself, and then the inside-out approach. In order to positively impact others, you must first improve yourself. That's the classic. So far, so good. And now, what does the Rebbe say? So, as we said earlier, the Rebbe's approach is radically different and counterintuitive as well. The Rebbe says, to sum it up, go big, go bold, and there's no time for delays. And this is, just so you know, this is not just a one-off time that he said this, or two or three times. This is like a doctrine that you heard again and again over 40 plus years. And it was all based on a statement of one of his predecessors, the fourth Chabad Rebbe, summed up right here in text number 5. Eloise, if you'd be so kind to read that for us.
The world advises that when facing an obstacle, if you cannot go under it, you must leap over it. I maintain, leap first.
Go over to any Chabadnik. And if you want to test him to see if he or she is a Chabadnik, ask them if they know what the two words mean as follows. L'chatchila ariber. If they don't know what those two words mean, they're fraud. They're not the real deal. I'm just kidding. But this is such basic doctrine, and it's all based on this saying of Rabbi Shmuel, the fourth Rebbe, but he said it once or twice. The Rebbe took it and turned it into a way of life. What is this way of life embedded in these words? He said the typical approach is if somebody faces a challenge, if someone gets into a problem, what do? They try to analyze the problem, try to solve it from this direction, from this angle. If that doesn't work, you try solving it from the other angle. And if those two don't work, you try a new creative path. And if all those don't work, then you kind of leap over. The Rebbe says that immediately you should leap over. Don't get caught up and bogged down by the issue, overanalyzing it and trying to work your way through it. Because when you get into a problem, you get caught up in a problem, and you can sometimes become part of the problem. Instead, lechatchila ariber, leap first. That's the key words tonight. If you can't, this is the classic approach. The classic approach says, if you can't go under it, then go over it. The Rebbe's approach, leap first. Go big or go home, in other words. Leap first. And we'll unpack this, and we'll appreciate it a lot more soon. And we'll also, as we've been doing in previous weeks, we'll get into some case studies to see how this manifested in reality. So this approach, the lechatchila ariber approach, which means leap first approach, is it's definitely at odds with the classical approach to self-betterment. Because what did we just finish saying for the last 15 minutes? That before you start doing good, you first have to cleanse yourself. Before you want to positively impact someone else, you have to be a beautiful vessel yourself before you can try to beautify someone else. Here the Rebbe is saying something totally different. He's saying, don't delay. If you have an opportunity to do something good, don't pause and wait and start analyzing and saying, well, I don't know if I'm perfected enough to go start working on perfecting the world around me or perfecting someone else. He said, nowadays, the ship has sailed on that approach. We can't afford ourselves the luxury of delaying positive action until we ourselves are perfected on our own. And he very often quoted this statement from the Talmud in text number 6. Stuart, if you're okay reading that, please.
This world is like a banquet. Grab and eat, grab and drink.
What does that mean, grab and eat, grab and drink? By the way, I hope you had a cookie there, freshly made, in honor of the finale of the course. If you had one, have a second. Grab and eat, grab and drink. What does that mean? So if you've ever been to some elaborate, lavish banquet, and let's say you were invited to get there at 6 p.m., and it's just over the top and full course and an incredible smorgasbord, more than you've ever dreamed of. But for whatever reason, let's say you couldn't get there on time, and you show up really late. So normally, if you were there on time, you know, there was this guy in Detroit, there was a certain annual dinner of one yeshiva in Detroit. It's called Beth Yehuda, very well known. And their annual dinner is known to be like one of the annual affairs in Detroit, like 2,000 people. It's an Orthodox school, actually, and they always have a very high-profile guest speaker. There was this one guy in our shul. He always used to say, the Beth Yehuda dinner is coming up this week. I already started fasting. 3 days before, he already stopped eating. So what's the idea here? So he would show up on time to that dinner, no question about it. But other people, maybe you one of them, you would show up late. Now what if you get there and you hear that they're dismantling everything in 15 minutes? It's all closing down. Are you going to start going through the courses, or are you going to grab whatever you can before the doors close and take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and wrap this and wrap that and fill your pockets up and get whatever you can? And then once you have what you can, then you'll figure out and you'll go eat in the car or whatever. That is what the world is like today. We used to have the luxury. Back in the day, we had time. Maybe in the shtetl, maybe in the Alta Haim, as we called it. People took the approach of who am I to preach or to teach or to try to beautify or perfect those around me if I myself am not perfect myself. And they would spend decades studying on their own, meditating on their own, perfecting themselves, and maybe at some point they emerge to share something with the world around them. Today, the Rebbe taught, we're on the cusp of redemption. Today, it's a grab and eat, grab and drink approach. There's no time for the bottom-up approach. There's no time for the inside-out approach. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean to say that somebody should ignore themselves totally. That's obviously a wrong approach. But to wait until I am perfect before beginning to have an influence on others, that is the wrong approach. What he did believe is that they can both go together hand in hand. Not only they go together hand in hand, as we'll see later, through perfecting others, I will be perfecting myself, as we will see. This is the crux of the Rebbe's approach, which basically could be summed up as the top-down approach. We have no time today to go from the bottom up, and that whole approach of climbing the mountain and all the phases and steps that you need. Now, of course, if you're actually climbing a mountain, I'm not sure I recommend to skip any of those steps. But you don't have to be perfect before you start, and that could apply to anything. But certainly here, we're talking, when we say top-down, we mean that you can... The way you are, yes, you start working on yourself, but don't delay. Don't delay starting to work with others, as we will see this applied shortly to various different areas, and we'll appreciate it much more. In other words, it's totally okay to cut corners spiritually. If, as we'll see shortly, it's you don't need to be perfect before you start working, before you start sharing, before you start teaching. Again, we don't mean to say that you should live in denial and be a bad example and try being a teacher, because that's also not going to work and you're going to fail at what you're trying to do. But you could be imperfect. Let's take this idea. Is everyone kind of getting the gist of it, basically? Okay, now let's try to advance and kind of apply it to various different scenarios. We're in a race against the clock in the last moments before the redemption. We need to go straight for the prize. So, let's start with impacting others. We're going to visit with an actual scenario. We're going to start with the outside-in approach. We said the classic approach is inside out. You first do your work on the inside, and then you can reach out to others. The Rebbe promoted the outside-in approach, and we'll see what that means. We're going to start with an excerpt of a letter written by the Rebbe in 1959. And this letter is just one, but it's typical of many, many other letters and directives that made the same point. Marilyn, if you'd be so kind to please read text 7a.
You ask me, how can I involve myself in disseminating the teachings, directives, and practices of Chabad to others when I've not yet fulfilled the dictum, beautify yourself and only then beautify others? I have two responses to your quandary. Firstly, it is not acceptable to withhold these teachings from individuals in your surroundings simply because you are not the way you should be. After all, your personal deficiency is not their fault.
Do you hear this last line? This is a game changer. Mm-hmm. After all, your personal deficiency is not their fault. So this rabbi, I assume, was needed to be a teacher in his community where there weren't many others, and he was needed. And he was saying, I'm not ready to teach because I don't feel worthy. I'm not beautified. How can I go teach these big ideas to other people? And the Rebbe said, the fact that you're not perfect, it's very nice that you want to still do internal work on yourself, and you should continue doing that. But in the meantime, that student, it's not their fault that you aren't perfect yet. You have to get to work regardless. There was a student once in an audience with the Rebbe, and the Rebbe encouraged him when he goes back to his college, to his university, he should influence people, other men, to wrap tefillin, to fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin. But he said, Rebbe, you have to realize, I don't wrap tefillin myself. So the Rebbe said, so why is it their fault? So what? They still need you to help them. He flips it on its head. So this truism from the Talmud that you should beautify yourself before beautifying others, he doesn't negate that. It's not what he's saying. All he's saying is, don't wait to be perfect before you start beautifying others. And not only that, when you beautify others, it will actually get you simultaneously to be beautifying yourself too. Now, as we said, it's not the student's fault that you don't have your own act together to perfection. It's not a reason why they should be deprived of what they need. They need what they need. And if you can provide it, even if it isn't perfect, you should not be delaying, and you should be taking action to providing it. So there's basically two ways to approach an issue when I'm faced with let's just say this individual's scenario of him needing to be a teacher, but him feeling like he's not worthy. He's not spiritually beautiful himself, or knowledgeable enough, let's just say. So how do we approach the I'm still imperfect attitude? So there's two ways he can do it. He could, and it depends what the priority is in his mind. If what I'm thinking of first and foremost is me, if the premise is me, then yeah, you're right. If I'm not ready to be the teacher, or I'm not perfect enough, then maybe I shouldn't be doing it. But that's only if the premise and the focus is me. But when is that ever a good thing? The vast majority of times, it's the wrong approach. What I need to be thinking about is the other. What does the student need? If I'm thinking first and foremost about the student's need, then it's very unlikely that my conclusion is going to be that I'm not worthy enough to teach them. Because if I have something to share, then I need to be sharing it. And I have a responsibility to share it. The fact that I'm not perfect, okay, so you'll work on that. But that should not stop you from thinking about that student's need. They shouldn't be deprived of what they need because you still feel like you have work to do inside, as true as that may be. So this outside-in approach, so where's it starting from? It's starting from them. The inside-out approach is me-based. It's me-focused. Where am I at? Am I ready? Am I worthy? Can I go beautify others? But if I think about if I take the outside-in approach, that's the Rebbe's approach, then who am I thinking about? I'm thinking about them, not me. I'm thinking about the students. I'm thinking about their need. And that's what I should be thinking about. And if they're the priority, then my conclusion will very likely be different. It's going to be, well, then I do have something to share and I do have something to give immediately. So that was just half of the Rebbe's response. Marilyn, want to go with 7B, please?
Sure.
On 151.
Secondly, when you set the goal of beautify yourself, you must seek and exploit all possible methods and means of increasing your success. Now, when you are acutely aware that you will soon face numerous individuals and you will have to discuss important topics with them, that awareness will itself most certainly assist you in your battle for self-improvement and make your victory far quicker and easier.
Thank you. And here's the key. The first point was it's not their fault. You got to get to work. But what about this teaching from the sages that you should beautify yourself before you go beautify others? So the Rebbe continued that when you know that you're going to have to perform and you're going to be presenting and you're going to be teaching, you're going to be showing up as a role model for whatever given platform that is, that's going to compel you to accelerate the internal work as well simultaneously. And you'll advance and make progress on that front as well, knowing that you have to live up to a certain standard because you responded to the need of the students and you took up that role of teaching or mentoring or whatever it is in whatever the particulars are. So as we said, that's what it really boils down to. Is it me-focused or is it other-focused? So a good teacher masters a subject in order to teach it properly. But that's if you think about the teacher's needs. If it's the students need to learn, their need to learn spurs the teacher's self-improvement. So what's important here is that we realize that even though it's counterintuitive, even though it's outside in, the Rebbe's not ignoring the need for that person to beautify and perfect themselves. He's just saying that it actually is going to come together with you first going out to reach out to others and perfect others. We're going to go to our first lesson video. Fascinating story. I'm going to let it speak for itself.
Rabbi Meshulam Weiss and his wife Eileen were married in 1957. 3 days before their wedding, they had a private audience with the Rebbe.
So I gave the Rebbe the tzetzel, and the Rebbe looked at it, read it, and then he looked up, and he said to us, "Get it Yiddish?" So I said, "Yeah, I speak Yiddish, I say Yiddish," and my kava, she said to the Rebbe, "I understand Yiddish, but I don't speak it that well. I don't express myself that well in Yiddish." So the Rebbe said, "All right, when I speak to the chassan, I'll speak in Yiddish, and when I speak to the kava, I'll speak in English." And that's what he did. So maybe a few seconds goes by, and all of a sudden, my wife starts to cry. And she looks at the Rebbe, and she says to him, Can the Rebbe please ask the chassan to leave the room? I want to speak to the Rebbe in private. Well, I was in shock. I think the Rebbe was also in shock. And the Rebbe gave me a look, and I just backed out and walked out of the room. As I came out into the hallway, the Grona came running over and says, "Where's the collar?" I said, "She's still inside." He said, no, you can't do that. We don't do it that way. I said, "Well, that's the way it is. What am I going to do?" And maybe about a good 20 minutes goes by that my wife is inside with the Rebbe talking. And then she finishes, and she opens the door, and she says, "The Rebbe say you should come back in." So I come back in, and I forget exactly how we were talking, but we more or less, the chiddush was ending at that point. And we started back into the door, and the Rebbe got up from behind his desk, and he walked us to the door. And the two shoymen were waiting outside. My wife went on her way, and I went my way. And the next time I saw my wife was under the chuppah. And after the chuppah, we, of course, went into the yichud room. And as soon as we went into the yichud room, the first thing that came out of my mouth was, "What did you talk to the Rebbe about in there for 20 minutes? So my wife said, "Well, I hope you're not upset. I told the Rebbe I want to call the wedding off." This was, remember, Thursday night, we're getting married Sunday. And the Rebbe said, "Why do you want to call off the wedding?" So I said to the Rebbe, "Because I have a terrible temper. I have no patience, and I lose my temper very easily. And until now, there's something, you know, a chassan kala, he doesn't see everything because, you know, but once we're married, it won't take long, he's going to realize he made a big mistake. He married a wrong woman, or he married a shrew, and we'll probably end up in divorce." So I've been thinking about it, she said, and I decided I would rather not get married at all than get married and get divorced. So I said, "So what did the Rebbe say?" She said, "The Rebbe smiled, and the Rebbe said to me, in English, the Rebbe said to me, 'I'm going to tell you something. The Rebbe is going to bless you with many children, and the children will teach you patience. So there's no reason for you to call off the wedding. And until you start having the children, you should do volunteer work in the hospital, preferably with children in the hospital, and that will also help you become patient with people. And your temper will not be a problem.'"
How amazing of a story. Don't call off your wedding, get married, and you'll learn on the job. That's it. They had 14 children, by the way. But until the first one came, volunteer in a children's hospital, and they'll teach you patience. You don't have to be perfect to begin. That's the point. You don't have to. The inside-out approach would have said, "Well, I can't get married till I'm perfect, until I gain control of my temper." The outside-in approach, the Rebbe's approach, says, "Well, you can start even with when you're imperfect, but as you start, you'll also be doing other things to help train yourself to gain better control of your temper and to develop patience." All good? Okay, let's move along here. So that's issue number one, was how to work with others and engage with others. And now we're going to talk about charity. Of course, a well-known mitzvah. And this following text was delivered by the Rebbe in 1957. He actually, in this text, we'll see, he actually addresses a difficulty that and a question that he himself had, which he didn't do very often, but he did right here. And he then advances with an explanation. So, Paul, if you're okay reading it, text number 8, please.
charity should be given in an infinite manner. This was the first time I encountered such terminology applied to giving charity. As I studied the discourse, I asked myself how it might be possible to give charity in an infinite manner. After all, charity entails giving money or physical resources with monetary value. How can any physical entity possibly be infinite? Now, Judaism delineates several standards of charitable giving. According to the typical standard of charity, we donate one-tenth of our earnings. That is considered the proper minimum margin. Then there is the standard of one-fifth, which is considered a generous margin of our charity. Finally, there's the standard of charity referred to as charity of judgment, whereby we judge ourselves honestly to determine the amount we require to sustain our own existence so that we can donate everything beyond that amount to charity. According to the latter standards, our charity is not defined by a specific percentage. It is neither a tenth nor a fifth, nor even a specific figure greater than a fifth. Nevertheless, in the final analysis, each shelf giving has a limit. For even if we were to give away all that we possess, it would still add up to a quantifiable sum. Rather, there is an entirely different approach to giving charity, whereby we do not consider ourselves at all. Instead, as soon as we encounter someone in need, our response is to immediately resolve that need, however large it may be, without considering whether we own that amount or not. In other words, the degree to which we feel the pain of our fellow and relate to that need is infinite, unequivocal, and unconstrained, so that there is no room for any calculations whatsoever regarding our personal means. We have but one consideration. We must provide the needy individual with the amount they require. If we do not have that sum ourselves, we will put every effort into obtaining it. And when we truly make this resolve, God will certainly assist us in fulfilling this mitzvah.
Thank you for that reading. So just what's the crux of the idea here? So the Rebbe says he came across the term infinite when it comes to giving charity. But how can you give charity infinite? Even if I give everything I have, it's not infinite. It's still finite. So he said the only conclusion I found is that it's a question of attitude. It's not a question of amount. It's an attitude thing. When a need, when I'm confronted by a given need, an individual needs help, so what's my attitude? If regardless of how much I'll give, that's still going to be finite. Where do we find the infiniteness in this process? It's that when I identify a need, I resolve that I'm going to take care of that need 100%. Either it's going to come from my own pocket, or if it will come somewhat from my pocket, and then I'll get others onto the case. But the need is going to be addressed 100%. I'm not going to walk away from that need until it's taken care of. That is what it means to have an attitude of infinitude to charity. And by the way, the translation of the Hebrew of for the infinite is b'chal me'odcha, which we say in the Shema. B'chal me'odcha means limitless. So how do we apply that to charity? Exactly as we just said. But here, we're getting the same idea. We're getting the continuation of the Rebbe's approach, inside out or outside in. Before we discussed it in the context of perfecting yourself or perfecting others, now it's in the context of charity. The question again is, what is the premise? Is it me or is it the other? If it's about me, then okay, when it comes to charity, so I evaluate what I need and what I have, and I see what the obligation is. The obligation from Torah is to give 10% to charity, so I make sure I'm doing that. That's all me focused. And by the way, you can get by with your obligation even when you are me focused, but you're still me focused. The right way to do it The Rebbe's way to do it is to be other-focused. It's not about me and what my obligation is. If it's my obligation, I'm going to stop at 10%. Doesn't matter what my other 90% looks like. Doesn't matter how much potential more good I could do with the 90% that remains with me. I fulfilled my obligation, so I'm done. That's me-focused. When it comes to charity, we have to be other-focused. And if we're thinking about the individual or the particular need or the institution, whatever the context is, whatever the particulars are, if I'm thinking about the need, that then I could have an infinite attitude to charity because I could resolve to take care of it. And I'm not going to walk away from it until it's resolved, whatever it takes, whether it's coming from me or if I'll turn to other people to join me in addressing this particular need. Again, that would be the outside-in approach as opposed to the inside-out approach. If it's outside-in, it's about the needy individual on the outside. That person is dictating my attitude to charity. And that's how it should be. Not me deciding what my attitude to charity is, because then I'm stuck on me. That's inside-out. That's the classic approach. It's not the Rebbe's approach. All good? Okay, let's sum this up and we'll get another video, a beautiful story on this topic. So on being giver-focused versus receiver-focused, and then charity is limitless, defined by what is required to help a person in need. The following individual is Israeli, doesn't have the best English, but where he falls short, the subtitles will fill in.
Rabbi Moshe Tzur is the founder and administrator of a number of educational and charitable institutions in Jerusalem. In 1969, he was serving in the Israeli Air Force.
We was in Birgav Rafa without any good conditions and good food. One day stopped trailers and gave to each one of us a package. It's a Chag Purim Sameach from the Rebbe Milubavitch. And we all was wonder who is the Rebbe. And it was like a Fata Morgana in the middle of the desert to receive a piece of candy and regarding from somebody that really care for you. And I was very impressed. On 1971, in the Milchemet HaTasha, one day Chabad people asked us to put a tefillin. But at that time, you don't know if it's Monday or Tuesday or Shabbat, and all of a sudden somebody asks you to put a tefillin. So when I started to say Kriyat Shema, I tried to say it, Shema, Israel, and I knew it, so I said it like fluently, and then I got crying because it was very emotional for me, and since that days, I got back to my religions. When I come to Chicago, I got to know Rabbi Daniel Moskowitz, he shall rest in peace. I become very close to Lubavitch community and to Chabad, and he used to come to my warehouse every Friday in the morning, and one time they honored me in some dinners that the Chabad house did, and I was twice in it Yachdut with the Rebbe, and one time he asked me what I'm doing, and I had an idea to be helping some more Jewish community, and he was telling us how is important the mitzvah of Ve'avta l'racha kamocha, to love the others just like you love yourself. And the Rebbe was like asking a question, why is the heart of the person, of the human being, is in the left side? Because in Judaism, the right is the chesed. If it's so important, why Hashem didn't make the human being create that the heart will be on the right side and not in the left side? So the Rebbe, he should rest in peace. He say that when a Jew look at the other, he have to know that the heart is for the others. Because when I look at you, your heart is in my right hand, and my heart is in your right side. So when the heart is over the other, then you really make the mitzvah of ve'avta le'racha kamocha. Because the heart is not for you. The heart is always for the others. Since then, thank God, I came back to Israel and I established two important yeshivot and four kolelim. And I think that the Rebbe definitely did a very important message in me and in my mission as a Jew. He changed all my perspective about life.
Another amazing story. A total paradigm shift. Our heart is on the left side because it's the right side of the other person. And we only have a heart to share and give to others. Again, this sums up this idea so beautifully that the question is, what is the basis of our attitude? If it's me-based, then the heart should have been on the right side. But because we're other-based, and when it comes to charity, we think about the other, that's why our heart is on the left side. It's the right side of the other person. Okay, now we're ready to continue. Any question or comment? I guess we're okay. So finally, our third big idea for tonight was the secret to Chabad success. So many have marveled at what the Rebbe's global army of emissaries have accomplished throughout the world ever since he sent out the first couple in 1951 to Casablanca, Morocco. And today, of course, 2024, in June will be 30 years since his passing in 94, and there are more emissaries that moved out of New York to their and took up posts after 1994 than did before 94. And many of them, obviously, certainly the ones going out in the last 5 years, were born after 1994. Not only didn't meet the Rebbe, they were born after that. So they couldn't have had that personal interaction to be inspired directly in person. But this says a lot about the Rebbe's ideas and his worldview, that it's outliving him. It's passing the test of time. That's really the true testament to a leader. Does an individual pass the test of time? Or, as many feared, certainly the pundits feared in 1994, that with the Rebbe's passing, the Chabad movement will begin to fade and to dwindle. And one of them, Ari Goldman, who was a writer in the New York Times, who you can see what he wrote in the week of June 13th, 94, of what would happen to Chabad. And 10 years ago at the 20th Yahrzeit, he was interviewed, and he himself said how wrong he was with his speculations and predictions of what would happen to the Chabad movement. So the question is, what is the secret to the success? What can we attribute it to? And of course, it's certainly not one factor, but tonight we're going to discuss one big factor. And an example of this approach, we're going to find in a letter that the Rebbe wrote in 1951. We're talking about within months of him assuming leadership of the movement. And he wrote to the administrator or director of a yeshiva in Montreal, Canada. Where are we? Elena, are you okay to read? Please, text number 9. Let's see what the Rebbe wrote.
Regard to the discussion at your meeting concerning the deficit in the yeshiva's budget, I have already addressed this in my earlier conversation with you here in New York. Up until now, you try to run things in a limited way, i.e. to direct your spending in accordance with your income. You should now try the opposite approach. That is, to endeavor to increase your income in accordance with the needed expenses. This is in accordance with the saying by the Rebbe Meharash, which was given over by my father-in-law, the Rebbe, in the name of his father. The world advises that if you cannot go under an obstacle, you must leap over it. I maintain leap first with a proper determination.
Thank you. You see, it comes back to the same teaching that we started with. Leap first. What's the Rebbe writing to this administrator in Montreal? Not to act irresponsibly. That's not what the Rebbe's message. His message was, what is your attitude? Are you thinking about the budget, or are you thinking about the students that need to be educated in your yeshiva? Are you thinking about the children that need to be admitted to the school, or are you thinking about the account of the yeshiva? What's first? Of course, you have to think about both, but what's the premise? Until now, the Rebbe said you're thinking about the budget. First, you're evaluating how much money you could raise, and then you're saying, well, if that's the money that we have, then we can accept X amount of students based on that. He said, you have it all wrong. You have it all wrong. You're following the inside-out approach. That's wrong. The outside-in approach is correct. You have to first see how many potential students you can bless with a Jewish education. Once you have that number, then you can design your budget based on that. And then you'll go raise that money. But then you'll be thinking about the need. You'll be thinking about the students. There'll be no child who needs a Jewish education is going to be left behind and unaccounted for and neglected because, well, it wasn't in the budget this year. We're so sorry. Come back to us next year. You would never hear that from a Chabad administrator, ever. Why? Because they take the outside-in approach. And my friends, it worked. Because we all know that there's, what, I lost count already. Is it 4,500 or 5,000 centers all over the world? And this is the approach they take. And this is why, because they take this approach, and I'm not saying there isn't pros and cons, but this usually comes along with the fact that there's less red tape. And that's why Chabad very often is able to respond to a need or a crisis, or if something comes up, they can immediately pivot because it's the same thought process. If a need arises, the need is speaking now, not the bank account. And we'll respond to the need. And if it means raising more money that we didn't know we had to, or if it means laying out money and then we're going to raise the money, okay, well, so be it. Of course, within reason. We're not talking about going bankrupt, but we're talking about the correct attitude and the correct mindset. And the mindset is outside in, always thinking about the need. And by the way, this is not, it's not uncommon that I get a question. Let's say I call a caterer before an event. And their question very often is, and this is true about many other vendors too, okay, so what's your budget?
Right.
I never have a good answer to that question. I say, I don't have a budget. First, I have to see how much, meaning let me know what the price will be, or give me two or three options of what we can do for this particular dinner. And whatever we decide on, I'm going to go raise that money. But it's after we decide what we're doing and what the need is, then we'll go find it. I'm not saying you always have to wait till after, till the day before. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, it's not like we decided a year ago what the budget is for this dinner and now fit it into that. That's not how it works. It's the other way around. It's what's the need. And of course, here I was talking about a caterer, but it's much more essential when talking about a child that needs an education or a child that needs to be admitted to a summer camp or a Sunday school, or a preschool, or whatever program, or a family to a synagogue, or to an event, or whatever it is. It's always about the individual first, and then you figure out how to address that particular need. But no one is ever turned away because, well, it wasn't part of the budget when we planned it. There's no such thing. And for that matter, and this was kind of mentioned before the class, this approach, this outside-in approach, when it comes to operating an organization, is very much in line with the Chabad approach to large families, too. Someone actually told me, a doctor friend told me recently, that he had a patient. Of course, he didn't tell me who it was. And this patient said to the doctor that apparently he's a religious Jew. And he said he already has a child, but he doesn't have a very good income right now. And he wants to have another child, but he feels it's a little... they're not ready, or they shouldn't go ahead with it because he doesn't know if he'll be able to support this child. I'm guessing it's not a Chabadnik, even though religious. I'm not saying for sure, but if the doctor was sharing it with me, so I said, tell him that the Rebbe's approach here too was outside in. When God blesses you with a child, he'll also bless you with the means of how to support that child. He doesn't just give you the burden. He gives you the blessing, and part of the blessing is how to take care of this child. How are you going to support the child? So the Chabad family approach is, God gave you the ability to bring children into the world. Go do it. You don't first see if you have a college fund for them before they're even born or conceived. That's the wrong approach. The outside-in approach is leap first. Bring another blessing into the world. Exactly how? How are you going to figure it out financially? Don't worry about it. When it comes, everything will fall into place. And finally, one other place, and there's actually a letter in one of the supplement pages here. It may actually be worthwhile to read this one. That's how amazing it is. Do you have like page 164? Do you see like a letter in a shaded box there on top? Where are we? Russell, take it away, please. You asked
whether it is advisable to invest in the purchase of a large and beautiful building for the yeshiva, or whether it is preferable to initially make do with a more modest building. There is a famous saying of the Rebbe Maharash: the world claim that if you cannot crawl under an obstacle, try to leap over it. However, I say I should leap over it in the first place. We are also taught that when we proceed with determination, the results fall into line. I am therefore certain that if we pursue the option of a large building with the necessary determination, you will be successful.
Thank you. Should I go for the small building or the big building? Go big. The big building. Not even a question. Leap first, and everything will fall into place afterwards. Okay, wonderful. So let's advance for the final stretch here. First, we'll return to the theme that we started with when it comes to internal work. Let's just sum this up here. So we have the three scenarios that we spoke about for the outside-in case studies. First about the teacher, then about charity. And then we spoke about, this was charity already. And then we spoke about the reverse budget, determine what you need to accomplish, set the fundraising targets accordingly. And if God has presented me with his goal, God has given me the power to achieve it. And now the Rebbe's approach to self-improvement that we touched upon earlier. So we quoted from King David, the verse that said, first turn away from evil, and then do good. So how exactly does that work? So the conventional approach, the classic approach is that I shouldn't start doing good until I first clean out the intestines, as we said. But that was not the Rebbe's approach. The Rebbe's approach said, don't wait to do good until you perfect yourself, or before you get rid of your impulses or negative urges, because discussion is not exactly for now, but that's never really going to happen anyway, because it's not what a human being is. A human being is always going to have a drive to negativity. Now, of course, we can gain control over it, or certainly better control over it, as explained at length in the Tanya. But the Rebbe's approach was not that. Don't delay it before starting to do good. And he learned this lesson from an interesting place. Who knows what the first two of the 10 plagues were? Blood and frogs, exactly. So instead of worrying about your circumstances, think only of what needs to be done. Instead of climbing, leap. Oh, so coming to the first two plagues, I know we didn't celebrate Purim yet, and we're already jumping to the Seder, but by the way, tonight, today is the first day of the month of Adar, the second Adar. That means in 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, we're celebrating Purim. But just a word about the plagues before we start focusing on Purim. So the first one was blood, and the second one, frogs. So what exactly happened? So the Jewish people at the time, and this is true personally as well, when we have to step out of our own little mini Egypt, the Jewish people then were steeped in the wrong things. They were steeped in Egyptian culture, and their passions were in the wrong place. So normally, what are we supposed to be passionate about? Good things, holy things, doing a mitzvah, studying Torah, being a good Jew. That's where our passion should be channeled. And then we should be apathetic to negative things. But the Jewish people then were the opposite. They were apathetic to the good things. They were passionate about the wrong things. This is what the first two plagues came to address. The first plague was the plague of blood. What happened? The water transformed to blood. Water is cool and wet, represents apathy. Turned into blood. Blood represents warmth, life, and passion. So the water turned into blood. What does that mean? That they were things that they were apathetic to until now. They needed to change and become passionate about it, which are good things and holy things. Transform the water into blood. That's the first thing. The second plague was cold-blooded frogs. And what happened with these frogs? The verse itself tells you that they went everywhere, all the way into their ovens. It says, Bitanu Recha. The frogs even went into the ovens of the Egyptians. Why do we need to be told that they went into the ovens? Because here the opposite thing happened. Here we're talking about things that they were cold, things that you're supposed to be cold to. So what happened at the time is that these frogs went into the ovens, meaning that what they were cold to, now they cooled down the passions that they had for the wrong things. They were passionate about the wrong things. That was cooled down. Instead of being passionate about negativity, so that was cooled. While they were warmed to the right things, they cooled down from the wrong things. These two things happened. So the question is, which thing happened first? These two things that had to happen, you would think that first they would cool down the passions that they had for the wrong things. You think that would go first. Then you can kind of warm up to the good things. First you have to get away, do no evil, and do no damage, and then you can do positive. That's not how it worked. The plague of blood came first. In other words, the first thing that they did was to get involved in good things and to channel their passion and their warmth and their life into positive things. The next thing was, the second plague was, to cool down and become more apathetic to the things, the wrong things that they were passionate about. Following? So it was the first plague that you would think, it's counterintuitive. The inside-out approach would call for the frog plague to go first. But the Rebbe's approach is what actually happened. That's the outside-in approach. The plague of blood came first, because that replaced apathy. Unlike the second one was to cool off unholy passion by cooling off the ovens. They were cooling off. By the frogs going into the ovens, they were cooling off the ovens, so to speak. In other words, cooling off the passion for the wrong things. But that came second. So here we have a very powerful reminder that when it comes to our own personal work, the Rebbe's approach was, don't wait until you're feeling cleansed from negativity, from negative energy, before you start taking in positive energy. Immediately start taking in positive energy. And that itself is going to help you get cleansed from the negativity. counterintuitive. Let's see text number 10, where we learned this from Abraham, and we'll tie it all together. Where are we? Ron, if you don't mind, please. 156. Text number 10.
Both the narratives, including the Torah, serve as directives and guidance for all generations to come. Similarly, the Torah's account with the plague of blood and representing warmth and passion for doing good, preceding the plague of frogs representing dispassion for negative matters, directs us to follow suit. We must focus on doing good right from the start. As the Rabbi Maharash says, the world advises that when facing an obstacle, if you cannot go under it, you must leap over it. I maintain leap first. Consequently, we also need this approach of leaping over in the sense of immediately working to reveal an abundance of light that will consequently on its own dispel the darkness.
Thank you. What does the idea tell us? To flood your life with warmth and holiness, and there won't be any room for bad. Don't wait to get rid of the bad. Let the positive energy itself do the cleansing of the self, and the negativity will be banished by the positive energy. Again, outside in, coming back to the Kutsk Rebbe, he once was asked, so how is it that you get your students to not sin? What's the trick? What's the magic? He said, my trick is, I keep them so busy they have no time to sin. It's not about overcoming and ridding themselves of their evil inclination. It's being so flooded in positivity and in good deeds that there's no time for anything else. There's no room. There's no openings. There's no cracks. And the good and the positivity itself cleans out the system. So everybody is familiar with, raise your hand if you've ever been stopped by a Chabadnik somewhere and offered Shabbat candles or to wrap tefillin or asked if you were Jewish. Okay, at least half of you. Majority. So, what's the deal with that? So, we know that that was the Rebbe's approach to one of the approaches to outreach, to go out there in the street and approach people, ask them if they're Jewish, and if they are, depending on what holiday is, maybe with a lulav for a blessing. If it's a regular Friday afternoon, it would be Shabbat candles for the women, tefillin for the men, a word of Torah for anybody. What's the deal with this? In fact, there are many others, other Orthodox leaders criticized it when the Rebbe started in the 50s. And even in the 40s, in some ways, when his father-in-law was still the Rebbe, they criticized it. Because you're taking mitzvahs, these holy objects, you're taking them to the streets, you're taking tefillin to Times Square and approaching people and wrapping them on people. You don't know what they did 5 minutes ago. You don't know what they ate. They didn't wash their hands before. You don't know what they're going to be doing in 5 minutes from now. Why are you contaminating the tefillin? Etc. All these types of arguments. Now, of course, I mean, they were all refuted. It was obviously proven to say that thousands and thousands of Jews returned to their Jewishness because of these encounters would be an understatement. I mean, you just heard from that one rabbi who spoke about the story with the heart. He was encountered in an army base in Israel on Purim. He wasn't religious. And today he's administrator of yeshivas and open institutions. It all started from an encounter like that. And this is true thousands and tens of thousands of times over and over. So it's proven to be successful. That's not even the question. That's not debatable. But decades later, the same people who criticized it at first started to replicate. As they say, if you can't beat them, you join them. And now they too are engaging in outreach. But in one area, to some degree, they're missing the point. They're doing it, they're trying to replicate it, but they're not really getting the Rebbe's outside-in approach. And that is that some people think that you don't immediately go to a mitzvah before explaining what the mitzvah is, before learning a little bit about Judaism. Now, you can say use it again to wrapping tefillin on the street, different argument, not that you don't know what this person did 5 minutes ago or in 5 minutes, but you could say that you don't know what they don't even know what they're doing. How about invite them to a class first, teach them about the mitzvah, or teach them about Shabbat before you start lighting Shabbat candles, and then with time they'll do the mitzvah. That would be the inside-out approach. The Rebbe's approach was to leap first, to do the mitzvah. The act itself is magical in any case, but certainly when it's a divine act. When you do that one mitzvah, even in the most random place, sometimes precisely when it's in a random place, sometimes has such a deep impact, and that is the beginning of a journey to learning. Why? Because it's outside in. And that was the Rebbe's approach to outreach, and that has proven radically successful. I'm not going to read text number 11 because we're a little short on time, but I would encourage you to read it. It does make this point, how we find with Abraham himself, the first thing God told him to do when he appeared to him, when Abraham was 75, Lech Lecha, the beginning of the third Torah portion in the Torah, God didn't start with bringing Abraham into to a class. The first thing he told him was go. Immediately it was an action, because when you fulfill a divine commandment, you establish a connection, an eternal bond, and then everything follows after that. So, sometimes, by the way, not only people on the street, sometimes we use this as an excuse. Sometimes when we need to embrace something new in our Jewish journey and grow in something, we say, well, I want to learn about that first before I start doing it. So we need to know that that's not really a worthy excuse in the Rebbe's worldview. That's an inside-out approach. The Rebbe's approach, the outside-in, is don't delay doing something good just because I don't fully appreciate it yet intellectually. And he often would say, when somebody would use this argument, it's not in the book, but nonetheless, he often would say, tell me, have you been to the doctor? Did he give you medication? Tell me, do you know exactly how the medication is curing you? No, so why are you taking it? Well, because the doctor said to take it, and it's going to do the job. Exactly. So, for the same token, when we do a mitzvah, even though we don't know and understand exactly what the dynamics are and how what their impact is in the person fulfilling the mitzvah or in the world around us, we should trust the doctor of all doctors, God Almighty, that we are unleashing positive divine energy into ourselves and the world when we do what we need to do. We're going to go to the third and final video for today. It brings home this point, and then we'll wrap it up after that. Do a mitzvah, do the mitzvah. Oh, top down, just do it, it says. Do the mitzvah, the understanding and feeling will flow from the action.
In 1969, Mr. Gordon Zaks was chairman of the UJA's Young Leadership Cabinet. Shortly after delivering a keynote address to 3,000 communal leaders from across the U.S. and Canada, he was informed that the Rebbe wished to meet with him.
I'm escorted into the Rebbe's study. And I'll never forget it if I live to be 100. There are books piled all the way to the ceiling, all around the office. He stands up. He has these penetrating blue eyes, crystal clear eyes. His skin is almost translucent. I mean, not a wrinkle. Just an incredible, peaceful, penetrating look in his eye. He said, Mr. Zaks, I have read your speech. It is clear to me that you have taken good care of your mind. I can look at you, and it's clear to me that you've taken good care of your body. What are you doing for your soul, Mr. Sachs? That was the opening to the conversation, which lasted an hour and a half. So he says, do you believe in revelation? I said, I believe in God, but I'm not sure I believe in Revelation. I believe that the Bible was inspired by God, but I haven't yet accepted the fact that it's word for word written by God. Now listen to this. I mean, this is when it really gets amazing. He says, Mr. Zacks, your problem is you're trying to think yourself to God. You can't think yourself to God. You have to experience the why, the how of being Jewish. And in the living of a Jewish lifestyle, you will discover God. He's within you. But you're trying to connect to him through your head. You have to connect to him through your heart. And you can't get there through your head. You got to get there through experience. He says, let me send a member of my community to live with you for a year and teach you how to be Jewish. If at the end of the year you find God in your soul, in your heart, you have achieved the greatest gift that you will ever have in life. You've got to release yourself from this mental approach to life and God and come with me in this journey of the heart.
So, first of all, that point is made that it's about action. And if we start living Jewishly, everything else flows afterwards. This was in 1969, just as a fun fact, follow-up. The next time he visited the Rebbe was in 1988. And this time it was online, as we saw in other videos, when the Rebbe was meeting people and giving each person a dollar bill for charity. And we're talking about a few thousand each Sunday. On one Sunday, Mr. Gordon Zacks approaches. And he approaches the Rebbe and he says, hello. And the Rebbe says, so tell me, since we last spoke, what have you done for Jewish education? And he says, you are amazing. It's been 19 years. You are amazing. There's actually a video of it. And the Rebbe looks at him and says, how exactly will it benefit the community if I am amazing? In other words, it's not about me, it's about the community. It's the opposite direction. The premise is not me being amazing. The premise is how the other is going to benefit from it. So, with that, let's return to the exercise that we started with on page 159, and. Right now, I believe, if you're going to revisit this list of six priorities, earlier, some of you said that number six would be, the first five would be to focus on the self, and number six would be to focus on others. But I suspect that you would bring that one much earlier into the process now. If not first, maybe second, but certainly not to wait until we are perfect ourselves before beginning to engage with others. Because the key is, what's that?
I marked it as number one at the very beginning of the class.
We know you're a Chabadnik, Marilyn.
I thought, oh my God, did I do it wrong?
So,
feeling better.
Exactly, way to go. So the Rebbe is all about, as they say, it's a Hebrew word, but they say it in Yiddish, all about tachlis. It's all about what is going to be the takeaway. And about action. So we establish the approach, the leap first approach, and it's always about seizing every opportunity that we have to do something good, to do something for ourselves. You have an opportunity, we do it. We don't start thinking, is it for me? Is it not for me? Am I up to it? Am I not up to it? We would be hundreds of steps ahead if people were willing to just take that leap and do that, take the outside in approach. And that's true when it comes to others as well. So If you don't mind, I'm just going to ask you, as we sum up and close out this incredible course, we spoke about, if you take a look on 160, we spoke about work, we spoke about family, physical health, emotional health, life's challenges, and tonight, finally, self-improvement. And the key really is, what is what's going to be the takeaway? So we know that, actually, on page 161, we have a whole list of the Rebbe's mitzvah campaigns. And I actually want to just close with this episode. And that is that a few days after the Rebbe's passing, as I said, it was June 12th, 94, was within that week, literally a few days after, executives from Coca-Cola Company called the Chabad in Atlanta, Georgia. And Rabbi Yossi Liu picked up the phone. And they said that they've been following the news. It was covered, you know, nationally, the Rebbe's passing, and they learned about this incredible leader and Coca-Cola as the product and brand that it is. They kind of follow success stories, and they heard about him and read about him, and they want to learn more. So they want to come visit him in his office. And the next day, two executives showed up, and they asked questions about the Rebbe and his leadership and how he went about it. And how did he launch new campaigns? You know, when we launch a new product, they said that it's a process of 2 years from conception till it's actually on the shelves. And it goes through one phase and the next phase and tasting and this and that and marketing and branding and the whole deal takes 2 years. How did the Rebbe do it? And Rabbi Liu explained, because, I mean, he was someone that spent years and years at in the Rebbe's court as a student. And he said, on Shabbat, the Rebbe would launch a new mitzvah campaign, let's just say mezuzah or Shabbat candles or anything on this list. And within 2 or 3 days, the entire world was already being saturated with this new campaign. And they just could not wrap their mind around it. And obviously, you have to explain them what a Rebbe is and the reverence with which he's viewed, and that it's like a modern-day Moses and communicating kind of the call of the hour. And it just, they basically heard what he said, and they said, we hear you, we appreciate, and thank you for your time. They closed their attaché cases, and it was a different language. They were not able to absorb and actually take in what was being said. But that is the key, because that's the difference in between the inside out versus the outside in. And I'm going to ask you, before we literally stand up and walk away, take 60 seconds. And if you don't mind, please identify one idea. It may have been from the first, second, or any of the classes, or tonight. The biggest idea of the Rebbe's, it may be a particular mitzvah, an action-oriented thing that you're embracing, or it may be an attitude thing from one of the classes that really spoke to you, that resonated deeply, and that you are taking with you. Take a half a minute to think about it, and would love for you to share it. I think everybody will be inspired by everybody. Anyone? Stuart, please.
For me, one of the take-homes from this is really about work-life. And, you know, I think there, I always had a sense that Judaism sort of had a double feeling about making money and, being successful, that too much was not good. And obviously that's not what came away from this. And I love the idea that that work is a necessary part of our existence, and that you shouldn't retire until you absolutely can't do it anymore. I think that was a real take home for me.
Excellent, excellent. That was lesson one. Colin.
I do first and then you'll understand and learn.
Excellent. Leap first. Just do it. Next. Larry.
I'm not sure where this came from, but if I find myself doing something that's not right, I forgive myself, because I learned not to do it again.
Way to go. Way to go. And it's better Yeah, we that was one of the themes was to we called it in Hebrew Hesech Hadas, to distract yourself and don't get caught up with it and don't dwell on it, because dwelling on it makes things even worse. And tonight we learned to replace it immediately, to do positive, and that itself pushes away the negative. Yep. Eloise.
God mirrors our behavior.
Yeah, I can't remember which class that was, but we definitely spoke about it.
Physical health.
About physical health. Yes, yes. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Jane. Think good and it will be good. That was last week. Who knows? Every week.
Yeah.
Paul.
This is fairly simple, but it had a major impact on me. That lesson that we talked about, just change your life immediately by doing something different every day. Whether it's to do a mitzvah every day, whether it's to wrap tefillin, whether it's to go to shul. And I thought about that, and that's something easy enough to start with and then build on top of that.
Excellent. Just fill our days with... Occupy our days with positivity, with mitzvahs, and there'll be no room for negativity. Anyone else? Russell.
Yeah, I think, I'm trying to think, but I remember the idea, I guess it was healthy mind, the idea of anxiety and dwelling on something, but kind of change your mind, get your mind off of that and move away from that. Focus on something else and just move forward.
Excellent. Yeah, that was, I think, the third class. Wonderful. Anyone else? Okay, feel free to share afterwards, after we officially close. Thank you all for joining Advice for Life. I had an incredible journey, and I hope you did as well.